Okay, these are the dates that we are most interested in at this time. As we look at this list, we start out in 606, which is the first Babylonian incursion against Judah. And then we come down to 445, where Nehemiah rebuilds the wall. As we are getting closer to 445, we are also getting closer to what? Now, that's kind of a vague question, I know, so I'll try to restate it. We are getting close to the end of inspired revelation in the Old Testament. We're getting very, very close to the book of Malachi. It's just about to come to an end for a period of about 400 years. Now, we presently are in the book of Esther, so we have backed up a little bit from the time of Ezra back to around the year 480, 483, 479. We're somewhere in that area. And we remember that Xerxes of Persia is the Ahasuerus of the Bible. Now, at this time, as we begin the book of Esther, what big world event is taking place? Right on the doorstep of what?
Thermopylae.
The Persians are just about to invade Greece because they believe that Greece has kind of caused some rebellion that is going on in Ionia, and they want to put an end to that. So the Persians are not real happy with the Greeks because of rebellion, and they are not in the mood to tolerate rebellion. And that probably has something to do with what we are reading about now in the book of Esther. Now, Xerxes has a queen that he needs to replace. He has to replace Vashti because of her just huge offense. And if you read the first chapter, you probably looked at it and said, well, what was that huge offense that you're talking about? Well, the Persian guys evidently thought it was just a terrible thing that she did. So she was replaced. And in chapter 2, Esther becomes queen. Mordecai reveals a plot to the king. And so they are both in place in the palace. And now in chapter 3, we are being introduced to the villain. The villain's name is, in unison, all right, the villain's name is Haman. He is promoted over the princes. He is the grand vizier. All right, now this is just for later use. If you are the grand vizier, would it be unusual to be invited to lunch with the king? Probably not, because he is the king's executive officer. He's the one that when the king wants something done, he's the guy that gets the order, you see that this happens, and you make it happen. So he is a very, very big man in the kingdom. He is used to being with the king and working closely with the king. Now in chapter 3, Haman is tremendously upset. Why is that? Bill, do you remember? Oh, that's right. Okay, why was Haman so upset with Mordecai? He would not bow down and he would not acknowledge Haman's just wonderfulness and greatness. And Haman got tremendously irritated at this. And it's probably personal. You know, we know from other places that, you know, Jews would bow down to the king and Jews would bow down to dignitaries, but Mordecai was not interested in bowing down to Haman. And Haman is really upset. And how far is he willing to take it? Chapter 3 and verse 6, the word we use is genocide, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, which means in his mind, just killing Mordecai wasn't good enough. He had to do more. For they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. He's going to get all of them. And then in the seventh verse, he is casting lots. to figure out the month and the day. So evidently the Grand Vizier is superstitious and believes in the same kinds of things that some of the other Persians believes in. It's the first month, the 13th day, when they start casting lots, and they will determine that this great massacre is to take place when? 12th month, 13th day. So they've got almost a whole year to get ready for the massacre. And in verses 8 and 9, the reason for this that Haman gives to the king is because we've got a... Did he say the Greeks or the Ionians or the Indians? Did he identify anybody? We got a certain people here. We got a little group, not even worth mentioning their name. And what's the problem with them? They have different law. Different laws than we have. What else? They don't keep the king's law. And it's just not in the king's interest. Isn't that funny? He can give 14 reasons why the king ought to get rid of these people, and never once does he come out and say what the real deal is. Is it common for people to act that way? You know, go all around it. I'll give you every reason in the world why I'm doing what I'm doing, except the real reason. Somebody remind me, this has to be trashed. Well, which one is it? All right, back in chapter 3, we pick up in verses 12 and 13. In verse 12, then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. How far into the empire did this decree go? Whole empire. If you back up to chapter 1, verse 1, keep your finger there. It took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. That's a lot. And the decree went everywhere that the Jews were to be, all right, how many terms do you read? Destroyed? What else? Killed? Annihilated? I don't think I understand what that means. Destroyed, killed, annihilated. Why in the world do you make a point of throwing all that out there? So nobody goes, I don't understand what we were supposed to do. They put this in no uncertain language, that these people are to be annihilated, and how long is it supposed to take? One day. Which means that when that day comes, how big of an uproar is it going to be? It's going to be a big day. Men, women, and what? Everybody. I mean, this is total massacre. And by the way, what do we do with their property? We seize it. We take everything they have. So you can't say there hasn't been mass destruction of the Jewish nation before, but I mean, this is Hitler-like stuff we're talking about here. total destruction and seize the property. That's what the goal is. Now, in verses 14 and 15, we see the reaction when this took place. Larry Linder, would you read that for us? Okay, the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Does that kind of indicate that, are there some decrees that go out from the government that everybody kind of scratches their head and says, what's that all about? That ever happened to us? Our government comes up with some kind of law that says, okay, we're going to do this, and we go, what? That happens quite often. And that seems to be what's happening here, because there doesn't seem to be any reason for it. Now, we notice how they reacted to the news here. Can you conceive of being in that position that they're suddenly in, where all of a sudden you get similar kind of news where the government is out to get you? It wasn't yesterday. But all of a sudden today, you're a felon and a lawbreaker, and we're after you. Play some mind games for a moment. Think about the fact that while we can't say that we're not interested in the king's law and we're doing things that are not in the government's interest, as children of God, do we kind of go by a different law, different set of values? And could that possibly open us up to retribution from the state of California? Possibility? Okay, just play this scenario in your mind. State of California says, if your church won't conduct gay marriages, we're going to confiscate your property. Totally beyond the realm of possibility? I like to think that it is, but you remember last week a case went to the Supreme Court that started about 2 years ago in Colorado. Anybody remember what that case was? The wedding cake. What was that about? Cake maker in Colorado. Two men came in and wanted them to make them a wedding cake, and the guy said, no, I am religious and I just don't do that. And what happened? They pretty much lost everything on that deal. I went to the Supreme Court last week, made it clear to the Supreme Court, I don't believe the Supreme Court has issued their ruling yet. That will be an interesting one to hear. Just on the basis of that. Now, having said that, knowing what happened to that guy in Colorado, could you envision a time when the state of California decided to make things difficult for groups that said, no, we don't do that? You can envision that. It's getting easier. I'm not trying to scare anybody. I'm just saying, put yourself in that position mentally. Say you're in a place like Zimbabwe. Now, stated this Sunday, new sheriff in town. Mugabe isn't there anymore. Military takes over, and it looks like it's going to be better, maybe. But is it feasible that in a place like that, the military steps in and says, you know what, those members of the Church of Christ, I think it would be in our best interest just to shoot them. What would happen? They would shoot them. Is it beyond the realm of possibility? Definitely not. Have they had genocides in Africa in the last 20 years? So, you know, we have things like this that in different parts of the world are definitely within the realm of possibility, where all of a sudden Christians wake up one morning and the government's out to get them. What is probably the best New Testament book to read for people who woke up one morning and found out the government was after them? There is a book expressly about that. 1 Peter. Put a marker in Esther and let's go to 1 Peter for a moment. Make a mental note. Just in case it ever happens in your lifetime. If the government one day decides it's just going to come after you because of what you believe, take a look at 1 Peter. You might not like what it says all the time, but it's God's word. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. All right, in chapter 1 and verse 6, rejoice, even though you're distressed by various trials. Now, what are these various trials that he's talking about? Background of 1 Peter is what? Rome decides you're not a legal religion. And as a matter of fact, you probably ought to be dead. This is the kind of background we're talking about. All of a sudden, Christians wake up one morning and they're illegal. Starts out by saying rejoice, even though you're in distress. Let's go to chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, putting aside all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babes, long for the pure milk of the word, so that by it you may grow in respect to salvation. Now, if the state of California is coming after me, I say to myself, well, wait a minute, we got to take a little break here. I'm not worried about growing as much as I am fighting and surviving. Is there ever a time when a Christian's not interested in growing spiritually? Even in really bad times? I mean, this is the background. The government's coming for you. So, you know, just forget the concept of growing spiritually. We don't do that. Let's look at chapter 2 and verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, rather to a king as the one in authority. All right, we'll just put that up there. Submit yourselves. Is it the aim of the Christian to be a rebel rouser? Did Peter say what you all need to do is band together and form Christian armies against the Roman Empire? Didn't do it. All right, let's go to chapter 3, verses 15 and 16. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. Be ready to make a defense. Be ready to talk to people about what you are. Now, if the Roman government is out to get you, you think it might be a good time to shut your mouth? Be a little bit incognito. Says people want to talk, you talk to them. Sometimes when we deal with that verse, we look at it in the concept of a big polemic. Like, okay, I'm going to be asked to stand up before the Garden Club Society. That's not the background. The background is they're coming for you. You be ready to talk and tell them what you are. Chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. 15. Make sure that you don't suffer as an evildoer. If I'm suffering as an evildoer, is there any glory in that? That's my dumbness. That's on me. I have nothing to be proud of if they lock me up because I robbed a liquor store. What if I'm suffering because I'm a Christian? Spirit of glory and of God rest upon you. If we talk about reaction to political trouble, remember, 1 Peter is the book that tells Christians how to react to political trouble. Now, if somebody says, are there any questions that you can interject into the controversy? There's always questions you can interject into the controversy. But if you're just sitting there wondering, well, you know, theoretically, the government's going to do something, how does the Christian behave? 1 Peter, read it, get an idea of what we intend to be if things go south. Now, why is it so hard for us to imagine that things could ever go bad? You live in a generation that never had to consider such things. Occasionally, in your mind, place yourself in that position and say, what am I going to do? If it ever comes down to the point where I wake up one morning and I'm being treated like the enemy of the government, what do I intend to do? Yeah.
That is a supreme example of courage.
Yeah. We have an example coming right up here in Esther. It's not quite the same thing. As a matter of fact, it's a little bit comical. How many of us can picture ourselves, okay, the decree comes from the state of California. Okay, all you guys, we're going to take your building. And by the way, we're going to take all your personal property too. Can any of you here picture yourself getting in an uproar and going out and going, I can't stand it, and yelling, screaming, and hollering? Going over the top and just doing that? I like Mordecai's reaction in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, when he finds out he's an enemy of the state. Oh yeah, that's the term, the enemy of the state. Yes. I had a good friend, said, Scott, you know what the hardest scripture in the New Testament to understand is? And I said, what, Wayne? He says, you know, if your enemy hits you on the right cheek, turn to him the left. That's the hardest scripture in the New Testament to understand. That one's kind of like it. The idea it's better to suffer for doing right than for doing wrong. We are not inclined to suffer and take it lying down. But sometimes you have to, yes. Bill. You remember I said a minute ago there are questions that could be interjected? That's one of them. If we look at Mordecai's attitude, like the Apostle Paul's attitude, we could say Paul didn't submit. He says, I appeal to Caesar. Can you work within the system? Can you stand up for your rights and say what is right? And when Paul appealed to Caesar, they had a lot of soldiers that escorted him to Caesarea. Yes?
I think when he says submit,
Well, it, yeah, it would be a personal deal. And yet, too, when we talk about solutions to the problem, how many people went out and immediately picked up arms? What's Mordecai's solution? Esther, you need to go talk to the king because of the position that you are in. Let's look at chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. John Kent, would you read that, please? Okay, what's the general Jewish reaction, especially in Mordecai? Mourning? Is he quiet about it? Did he very silently go into his closet and say, boo-hoo? Sackcloth and ashes and wailing? And this is going on throughout the empire. And in verses 4 through 9, Esther is going to get wind of it. Now, here's a question. When Esther first gets wind of it, does she know all the details of what's going on, or does she just know that Mordecai's hollering and yelling and all the Jews around here are hollering and yelling? Or does she know the details? She does not appear to know the details. You know, it appears she just knows something's going on, and it's going to have to be explained to her. Verses 4 through 9. Brian, would you read that, please? Okay, you notice the fifth verse. She didn't know the what or the why of what was going on. So she sends somebody out there to put some clothes on Mordecai. Mordecai won't take them, but Mordecai is interested in filling her in that she gets the whole picture of what's happening. In the seventh verse, what does Mordecai communicate to them? The amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Now, this is a cheap point. This is one of those get it off my chest kind of things. Okay, you got the king of Persia, Xerxes, and Haman agrees to pay a big amount of money to take care of this official business. Did it seem to matter to the king? I mean, stop and you think. Bunch of people. They don't follow your laws. Let's kill them all. And by the way, I'll pay for it. King jumps at it. King of Persia. And it still matters to him that somebody's wanting to ante up the money. You're living in an era where, yeah, the kings are rich and they're getting all the money, but the money matters. Here's an old story. Sir Francis Drake, y'all remember him? Old guys, no, we don't remember Sir Francis Drake. Okay, does anybody know what got him knighted? Okay, here's what happens. Back in the days of Sir Francis Drake, he gets in a boat, and he's just a nobody, but he's a captain of a boat, and he goes sailing around, And he decides he can raid Spanish ships that are laden with gold and, you know, all the riches of the New World and whatever. And he goes on a raiding party, and he comes back with a boat that is filled up to here with Spanish gold. Brings it back to England, and every nobleman in England tells the queen, you got to hang this guy. He's going to get us into a war. And he looks at the queen and says, I have brought enough money to sustain Her Majesty's kingdom for at least a year, probably a year and a half. And she knighted him. Pardon me? I believe so. Yeah, I was trying to think about that. Which number Elizabeth was that? But to the Queen of England, did the money matter? Yeah, this is back at a time where even if you're a king, the money matters. You know, somebody's got to come up with the money, and Haman agreed to come up with the money, and the king jumps at it. Now, back to the text. He furnishes the information on how much Haman paid and a copy of the edict. Okay, you furnish a copy of the edict because you want to make sure Esther does what? If you're Esther, might you be tempted to say, nah, they wouldn't do that? Well, yeah, they would. Here's the edict that says they're going to do it. So the proof has been furnished, the numbers have been furnished, and he implores her to what? Go to the king and plead to him. Plead for his favor to the people. Now her initial reaction, verses 9 through 12. Andrew, would you read that, please? Okay, what's her problem? Mordecai says, I want you to go beg to the king. And she says, what? What's her problem? She's scared. Would you be scared? Is her life really on the line? Has this king already given proof that he's willing to take a queen and just sell her down the river? He's already done it once. Now, how old do you think she is at this time? An approximate age. That's a pretty good guess. That might be on the old side. In the third year, they started gathering the virgins. I don't know how many years it took them to do it, but in all likelihood, they probably gather them down to the age of 13 or 14. They take them young. That's the third year it starts. This is the 12th year. 9 years have gone by. If they took her when she was 14, how old is she now? 23. Anybody here in the 20, young 20 age bracket? Yeah, we got a couple back there. How interested would you be in walking up to the king and risking your life? Kind of a nervy thing. This is a young woman with everything to lose. And she is a little bit intimidated by the prospect. So she's a little bit slow to do this because it's a life and death situation. Now we have Mordecai's famous reaction in verses 13 through 17. Chris Garcia, would you read that, please? Chapter 4, verses 13 through 17.
But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether we have come to
Okay. Does Mordecai shame her a little bit? How does he shame her? Kind of reminds me of my dad, to tell you the truth, the way he might go about doing it. Don't think you can get out of this, because if you try, your whole family will probably get wiped out anyway, and God will do what? God will save the nation some other way. God's going to do it. It's just a question of whether or not you're going to have a part in it. That is kind of putting a little bit of pressure on her and shaming her a little bit. And he also floats a possibility. And what is this hypothetical, theoretical, speculative, and possibly true, and probably true possibility that he throws out there? You probably got put in this position just so you will be here at this point in time, so you can be used to help God's people. Does it say it for sure one way or the other? Doesn't say it for sure. This is a question concerning the providence of God and how God's providence works. You might put it this way. What is providence? When things break your way so much, when things break in your favor to such a degree that you believe God had to have a hand in it, even though you can't prove it. Yes. Yeah, the Jews understood the providence of God. That's why he's speaking the way he is at the moment.
Well, they already had evidence of that with Joseph. They already had evidence of that with
Joseph. Yeah, we brought this up, remember we brought this up a couple of weeks ago, great examples of providence, and Gary said Melchizedek, which we'll remember forever. That's one of the memorable ones, but great examples of the providence of God. We think about Joseph, we think about Esther. I mean, it's there. And he just throws it out there. You probably got put in this spot just so you could be helpful at this particular point in time. All right, now, done this before, do it again because I like to think about it. How many of you have been in a position where you believed that God intervened on your behalf, but you couldn't prove it to save your life? You ever been there? Most of us have. Somewhere along the line, something has happened, something has fallen out to your benefit that can't prove it, but I believe that God helped. And if you've never had that experience, you probably just weren't thinking hard enough. Any comments on that? By the way, Mirtheline. Yeah. This book is, if you talk about questions raised by a book, this is one of the most questioned books in the Old Testament. Anybody tell me why? God is not mentioned. Prayer is not mentioned. Is it hinted at? You know, when you say deliverance is going to arise from some other source, well, what other source would that be? Or if somebody says, you tell everybody to fast for 3 days and then I'll go to the king. You know, it's all hinted at. You know, it's just one of those oddities. If somebody were to ask, you know, why do you think that is? I don't know. You know, I really don't. It's just what is, and we look at the passage of Scripture, and it is hinted at, it is implied, but it is never stated. Now let's go back to the text. One more little point to make from this. When we think about her, she says, if I perish, I perish. All right, if I perish, I perish. If you're dealing with that situation, and it's yours to do, and you're going to be the one that has to go before the king, what kind of things are you telling yourself before you step up there? If I don't do anything, I'm going to perish. What if he kills me? God will take care of me anyway. There's a lot of things you tell yourself just before that moment. But the point we would make is, are there times in your life where you're going to have to step up, whether you want to or not? Happened with Esther. And that usually happens for all of us. There will be times in our life where we simply have to step up and put our fear aside. When we think about being afraid of something, we usually think about things such as we were talking about from 1 Peter. If you live in the Philippines, who are you afraid of? ISIS? You're afraid of Muslims? If you live in Africa, who are you afraid of? You're still afraid of ISIS. You're also afraid of the local dictator of the month, you know, whoever he might be. A lot of things to be afraid of, but do those people sometimes have to step up and say, I'm going to be a Christian anyway? All right, with us, if we talk about stepping up, yeah, it's possible that things might go bad politically. Let's go on the assumption they don't. And we keep living our lives for the next 100 years like we've lived them for the last 50 years. Are there still areas where we just sometimes have to be saying, I got to step up and act, whether I'm afraid to or whether I'm not afraid to? Okay, shine, speak, welcome, invite. How many of you are intimidated? And be honest about this, because this is just almost a universal. How many of you are intimidated by opening a religious conversation with somebody with whom you have not had that conversation before? Anybody? Yeah, a lot of us are. You probably won't believe it, I'm a very introverted person. I would have made a good hermit in some ways. Some of these things you have to learn by making yourself do them. And sometimes you just have to say, okay, I got to do this. If I perish, I perish. Sometimes we ask things like, well, what's the big secret about opening your mouth? There is no secret. What is the secret? You do it. You know, that is the secret. You just do it. You say, if I perish, I perish. And you just go ahead and do it. And usually, the scariest thing is just making the decision or the determination, I'm going to do it. And she decided she was going to do it. Now we will stop there and pick up next week with chapter 5.